So I was speaking to Steve a few weeks ago about preaching here, like I was saying, because this is an assessment for me. And he was like, no worries. We'll be doing Genesis. I'll give you an easy passage. It'll be good. You'll get a good mark. And I was like, perfect. That's what I want. I want a good mark. I want an easy passage. Next minute, I get this passage. Like, what is it about, really? Sarah is apparently so good looking that the leader of a foreign nation will kill her husband so she can marry him. And apparently she's about 65 at this time, so she must have been really, really good looking for a 65-year-old. They had longer lifespans and all that, but still it's quite a feat to be that good looking that someone will kill your husband. And then Abram thinks of this crazy plan. Just lie and say you're my sister. Everything will be all right. Like, what sort of plan is that? It's a terrible plan. Whoever thought of that plan? Idiot. And then Pharaoh gets punished for what Abram did. God punishes Pharaoh, right? Doesn't make any sense. God punishes Pharaoh for something that Abram did. This passage makes no sense. The more you are paying attention to the Bible reading, the less sense this passage makes. But it's the crazy passages in the Bible that reveal the best things and the most amazing things about God. So it took me a while to get to this one, but I think you guys will learn something amazing about God if we pay careful attention to this passage. So throw your minds back to 2 weeks ago, if you were here 2 weeks ago. What do you remember happened with Abraham? I think last week was Father's Day, so 2 weeks ago was the start of chapter 12. What happened with Abraham?
He tells Abraham that he's supposed to leave where he's at. I'll bless you for it.
Yeah, leave your land. Go leave the land and then I'll bless you. What are the blessings? Anyone remember? People kind of divide it into three blessings.
Great nation.
Yeah, nation. Nation is kind of two of them. So, what's involved in a nation? Yeah, nation, great name.
Nation as people.
Nation as people. How about I tell you the three that I'm thinking of? He'll have a land, he'll have a people, he'll have offspring, land, offspring, and he'll be blessed and he'll be a blessing to those around him. Land, offspring, blessing. So Abraham gets these promises. He ends up straight in the promised land, straight away. By verse 9, he's in the southern area, the Negev of the promised land. So that's where we start our passage today. Abraham gets the promises, land, offspring, blessing, and then a famine hits. Maybe a drought, whatever causes the famine hits. And Abram decides to leave the promised land and go to Egypt. And that's probably a bad start, right? God's promised you a land, but then you leave it and you go to Egypt. Depending on when you kind of date the writing of Genesis, the first readers of this passage might have been the generation that was sitting just outside the promised land. Their parents were saved from Egypt, and then their children, this generation, is sitting at the edge of the promised land, just about to go in. And they're hearing Moses tell them about this story of Abraham, who left the promised land and entered Egypt. They're obviously thinking, bad move. Even if it's not that generation, any Israelite or any Jew who hears leave promised land, go into Egypt, bad idea, right? But this is what Abram's doing. The Bible doesn't directly say that Abraham's doing a bad thing here. Doesn't make a kind of comment and say he was unwise or unfaithful, but I think we're meant to see that this isn't the best idea. So he leaves the promised land, heads towards Egypt, and gets to the edge. And then he turns to his wife and says, I know what a beautiful woman you are. I'm not a wife myself, but I watch a lot of TV. And what TV tells me is that this is a bad line. Because when a husband says this to a wife, there's something bad coming after it. I know you husbands here probably tell your wife all the time, you're beautiful. And you write love letters, you're so beautiful. And no strings attached, you just tell them they're beautiful. But Abram here, I don't think that's what he's doing. I think he's setting up for something else. And so my spidey senses are tingling. And they're right. He doesn't just tell Sarah she's beautiful. He tells her to lie because she's so beautiful. To lie about being his wife. To say that you're not my wife, but you're my sister. There's some theories about the culture and the context of what's going on here and what it means to be a wife and a sister. But whatever it means, he's basically saying for Sarah to say that she's an available woman. You're not my wife, you're my sister, you're available. And in her saying that she's available, it's going to be a good thing for Abraham, because he'll live and he might even get blessing. So he asks Sarah to lie. And it happens exactly as he thinks in verses 14 to 16. The Egyptians see that she's beautiful, in fact, very beautiful, and they tell Pharaoh. And Pharaoh takes her as his wife, and then he blesses Abraham. Exactly what Abraham thought in his crazy plan actually happened. And notice that it doesn't really mention Sarah. It doesn't say that she agreed to do this, doesn't say that she took part in the lie or even agreed to the lie. It really just focuses on Abraham. Because Abraham was the one that got the promises about the land, about offspring, about blessing. And it was Abraham that decided to leave the land. And it was Abraham that decided to give away Sarah, the only way he could have offspring. So it really focuses on Abraham giving away the promises of God. So here's Abraham, no land, and now no chance of offspring. He's lost 2/3 of God's promises to him. Then verse 17, after Abraham's made a few bad moves, God inflicts Pharaoh with diseases. Pharaoh gets a bad rap often because of the Exodus story, right? Like he's the guy with a hard heart. But this Pharaoh seems to not be that bad a guy, right? He's like, oh, Sarah, you're available? Why don't you be my wife? No, it's not such a bad guy. But then God inflicts Pharaoh. Like, what's happening here? Why doesn't God inflict Abraham? Abraham's the one that lied. He's the one that's left the promised land. I don't think this inflicting of disease is really a punishment, but it's actually Abraham losing the last part of his promise. Instead of being blessed and being a blessing to everyone around him, he's now become a curse to the people around him. He's not a blessing, he's a curse. So there's no land, there's no chance of offspring, and he's certainly not a blessing to the people around him. We might read this and we start to judge Abraham really quickly. Like, he's heard God's voice and he's giving them away so quickly. But I think the picture isn't that he's given them away flippantly, but that something's actually happened to shake his faith that God will fulfill his promises. Have you guys heard of the millennial drought? Anyone ever heard of the millennial drought? No one. So it was after a few years of build-up. In 1995, an official drought was declared in Australia, across the whole of Australia. And it lasted across the whole of Australia until 2009, and in other parts of Australia until 2012. So this is like our lifetime. It's 14 to 17 years, depending on how you count it. So for most of us, we've actually lived through drought for longer than we've not lived through drought. Did you even know that? Did you know you were in drought for 14 years? No clue, right? Drought and famine to us kind of means nothing. In the middle of the drought, 2002, that was like my peak eating days. I don't know if you remember what I looked like in 2002, but I didn't have a famine body. It was like the opposite of a famine body. So the word drought to us, it doesn't mean as much as it probably did to Abraham. For Abraham, famine means no food. And no food means, well, you know what that means. So Abraham sees a famine come upon the land and he has to make a decision. It's like God's promises don't look like they're going to come true. I'm in the middle of a famine. And so he decides to settle for something less. He settles for something way less than God's promises. So he leaves the promised land and settles for food. I'll go and just find food. We might also judge him for giving away his wife. This one's a bit harder to rationalise, but I guess if your wife's going to be taken anyway, you might as well give her away. I'm trying to rationalise. But you might as well give her away and save your own life and maybe get blessed rather than get her taken away and you lose your life. Kind of makes sense. So he makes the logical choice. I won't take God's promise of offspring. I'll settle for survival. I'll take food and I'll take survival. So here's Abram, the man that God's promised amazing things to. He's got some possessions. Like it does tell us he's got, you know, camels and donkeys and all that sort of stuff. He's got some possessions. But he's standing in a foreign land. He's wifeless. He's childless. And he's a curse to the people around him. It basically looks like God's promises have totally failed. And it's a position that is kind of relatable in that sense. Like you're just standing in the ruins of a broken promise. And so you take what you can get. It might be something small, like someone promised you an easy sermon, but it turned out to be the hardest sermon in the world. But you take it, right? You've got to do the assessment. Or maybe a school teacher or a lecturer said, easy test coming up. But you get into the test and it's a mega hard test. But you've got to take the test. Or it might be something bigger, more serious, like someone's offered you a promotion or something, but it doesn't come through for whatever reason, and you lose your job. And then you've got to take, instead of this dream job that you had your eye on, you just take whatever job you can because you have a mortgage to pay. Or maybe something more heartbreaking, like someone's promised to love you for your whole life, and for whatever reason, that doesn't happen. And then you take what you can get. So Abraham stands here with God and his promises looking like they've failed. So he settles for what he can get, food and survival. But there is verse 17. Verse 17 says, But God doesn't sit back and watch his promises fall apart. God actually acts. What I said before about Abraham losing the last part of his blessing with Pharaoh being cursed is true in one sense. But at the same time, that very action is God returning all the blessings to Abram. Because you see, when God inflicts Pharaoh, verse 19, Abram gets his wife back and his hope for offspring. In verse 20, he gets to leave Egypt with more than he came in. He gets to keep all those camels and all those donkeys. And then verses 1 and 2 of chapter 3, Abraham's back in the promised land. All of God's promises have been fulfilled. What looked like in verse 10, like the drought had beaten God or the famine had beaten God, by the start of chapter 3, you see that there was nothing that could overcome God's promises. Whatever it looked like to Abraham was not true. But God's promises will be fulfilled. So I said we'd learn something crazy about God, and here it is. God keeps his promises. Every promise that God makes, he keeps. And you can't really say that of everyone. I think you can only say that of God, actually. As most of you know, I'm the youngest in my family, and my brothers and sisters are a fair bit older than me. So when I was a kid, I think it was kindy or year one, I discovered Uno, and I loved playing Uno. But my brothers and sisters were heaps older, so they didn't want to play with me. They were like 18 and I was 5 or something, so they didn't want to play with me. But I really wanted to play Uno. So I made them make a promise to me. I made them promise to me that in the school holidays, each one of them would play Uno with me once per day for the length of the school holidays. Not only did I make them promise that, I made them sign a contract. So I wrote a contract. It was on a pink piece of paper. This is a real contract. I wrote it down, and they got them all to sign it, and I signed it as well. So this is a few weeks out of the holidays. I stuck it on my wall. Every night I'd go to sleep looking at my contract, waiting for my promise to be fulfilled, right? And then the holidays got closer and closer. And for dramatic effect, I'll say it was on the day the holidays started. I don't really remember. But on the day the holidays started, what do you reckon happened to my contract?
Disappeared.
It disappeared. I woke up that morning, I looked for my contract and it was gone. There was no contract. Right? This promise that they made to me, this contract that they signed, just disappeared, right? The promise was not kept. My siblings don't keep their promises, right? People in general don't keep promises. I don't even keep promises that I make to myself, right? I'm going to sleep early. I'm going to eat healthier. I'm going to exercise. And that's just in this week. I've actually made all those promises to myself this week. I've kept none of them. I don't keep promises to myself. Even the world is the same, right? The world doesn't keep its promises. TV will tell me that if I buy the Tower 200. Do you guys know what the Tower 200 is? It's like if you have a door, you have a gym. You guys know that, right? If you have a door, you have a gym. So you buy this thing, you attach it to your door, and it becomes a gym, right? You buy the Tower 200, turns your door into a gym, and then your door will give you a six-pack. That's the promise. And then your six-pack will give you a happy life, right? But not everyone, I'm sure, that owns a Tower 200 has a six-pack and a happy life.
They've got a lighter wallet.
Yes, they've got a lighter wallet, they do. Speaking of that, financial wisdom will tell me that if I can manage my money well, save money, buy a home, diversify my investments, have a good stock portfolio, I'll be able to have financial security, right? And then I'll have the freedom to do whatever I want. That's what financial wisdom of the world will tell me. But not everyone with money and riches has freedom. That promise doesn't come true for everyone. Culture will tell me, I think this is the one that applies to us most of all, I think. Culture will tell us that if we can chalk up enough experiences in our life, if we can eat the best foods, travel to the best countries, have the coolest experiences that no one else has, and if we can do it all while we're being authentic to ourselves, whatever that means, we'll be truly happy. We'll find true happiness. But not everyone that travels the world is happy, and not everyone that's authentic is happy. The world doesn't keep its promises either. I'm not saying all these things that I've mentioned are bad, you know, like health and travel. They're not bad, they're good and they're blessings. And if God gives them to you, you should accept them gratefully and be thankful. But the world promises these things without delivering them. The world doesn't keep these promises. But God does keep these promises. God is the only person, the only thing in the whole world that keeps every promise he makes. If you're a Christian here and you're chasing these promises, and we all do, like if we're Christians, we still do chase these promises of the world. If you're a Christian here and you're chasing these things, don't settle for the promises that the world gives you. God offers you greater promises and more sure promises. Refocus yourself on the things that God offers. If you're not a Christian and you're chasing these things, then consider what God offers. He offers you more than the world ever promises. And he brings them about more surely than the world could ever bring them about. These days, we've actually got more reason to believe God than even Abram did. So Abram heard the promises and he believed them and he acted on them. But we have more than that. We hear the promises as well in the Bible. But we also get to see how God fulfills those promises. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 verse 20 tells us that every one of God's promises are yes in Christ. So the song's got it right. Every promise of our God is yes in his own Son. Everything that God's ever promised, we've seen it fulfilled in Jesus. Everything they said. He said, we'll have eternal life. We'll have a treasure that will never perish, spoil or fade. We'll have life to the full, that will have rest. Whatever promise he's made is yes in Jesus. So we don't just hear the promises, but we see them being fulfilled. And we just await for them to come. So we have more reason to believe God now than Abram did. But just like Abram, when a famine comes and it looks like God's promises are failing, we're tempted to trade in God's massive promises for something lesser. Just like Abram was tempted by it, we're tempted by it too. We live in a country that puts our life on the line for being Christian, right? For trusting in God, we don't have to pay with our lives. Like, couldn't even consider that happening in this country. But there's lots of Christians that do. When a famine strikes their life, whatever that famine is, whether it's persecution or some other thing, they have the choice to live for themselves or to die for Christ. If God's promises are true and he's the promise keeper, then that choice to lose your life for Christ is worth it. It's actually worth it to die if God is a keeper of his promises, which is what this passage tells us. It's worth it. Here in Australia, our famines don't look like that. Our famines don't look like death and don't look like persecution. Actually, I think our famines look like living and living a great life. That's what our famines look like. Our famine is the fun Friday or the fun Saturday night out. If only we don't act like a Christian. If we speak like we know we shouldn't speak, if we drink more than we know we should drink, that's our famine, right? It's because God's promises don't look like they're coming true that we're tempted by these things. If we don't think that God's going to deliver on his promise, that he'll give us life to the full, when we're tempted to drink a bit more than we should or to speak like we shouldn't, we're going to take that temptation because God's promise doesn't look like it's coming true. But if we can trust this passage, and if we can trust that God does keep his promises, and his promises are better than what the world offers, then we can say no to that temptation and know that we're making the better choice. Not just a godly choice that our parents would like us to make, but it's actually a better choice to follow God. It's actually a better choice to follow God and not to follow the world, because he keeps his promises. That might be the famine for some of us. For others of us, it might look like something like wealth. If we only compromise on our tax, or if only we're not too generous with our money, or if we do some things that are slightly questionable at work, we can amass wealth and we can be financially secure. Because God's promise of an inheritance that will never perish, spoil or fade doesn't look like it's coming true. I can't see that coming true in this life. It looks like it's failed. But if we trust God and we know that God is the God that keeps his promises, even though we have mortgage payments and all these things, we know that we don't need to worry about amassing wealth, that God will fulfill his promises regardless of what it looks like. And again, this isn't to say that we should be lazy or unwise with our money, or we should just be really flippant in our spending and God will supernaturally fill our bank account. But it's a call to be faithful and trusting in God's promises, to know that we can be generous and we can live a bit more risky in our generosity, and God will still fulfill his promises. So these are my famines, I guess. This is what makes it look like God won't fulfill his promises in my life. What are your famines? What is it in your life that makes you think God won't or can't keep his promises? Whatever it is, this passage tells us that there's no famine, no drought that God can't overcome. He always keeps his promises. Even when, just like Abram, we inevitably trade a greater promise for a lesser promise, we give away something great for something average, like food or survival, even when we do that, God will keep his promises. So this is a passage that can give us strength and perseverance to last through and make the right decisions. But it's also a passage of hope that when we fail and when we make the wrong decisions, God will still keep his promises.